The next case for argument is 16-1278, Rocky Mountain Helium v. United States. Mr. Bush, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is David Bush. I'm here for Rocky Mountain Helium. We are here on an appeal from a dismissal under a Rule 12b motion to dismiss, which is a very high hill to climb. And there are many reasons that we can say that the Court erred, but I'm going to talk about just two. I think that will really encapsulate the main points here. First of all, the Court decided facts, and that had profound implications in its decision. Second,
can I ask you, I don't think that you disputed in your brief that it was proper for the Court of Federal Claims to look at the contracts at issue here in the same way that it's commonplace and proper, even on a Rule 12b motion, 12b6 even, to look at contracts and other documents attached to or incorporated into a complaint. Is that right?
That's absolutely right, we only found those documents helped us. So we had no reason to object to them being referred to by the Court and included with the briefings. The Court decided facts that had a profound influence on its decision, and it had no authority to define those facts. Secondly, the Court misread the dispute resolution provision in the settlement agreement, and it misread it in several respects, which I'll unpack a bit for you. But in doing that, it also had a profound effect on this decision. So those are the two that I wanted to talk about. Let me turn to the erroneous findings of fact, first of all. As a matter of deciding jurisdiction, if the truth of allegations are disputed, then a court may decide jurisdictional facts. There was no dispute here. If you look at footnote 2 of the motion to dismiss that the government filed, they said in there, for purposes of this motion, we are accepting all the allegations as true. And if you had any doubt there, look at page 11 of their response brief. They reiterated that. For purposes of all this, we are accepting as true the allegations by Rocky Mountain Helium. So there were no disputed facts. There was no truth that was being challenged that the Court could have used as a justification to decide jurisdictional facts. And the fact we're talking about kind of in two flavors. Flavor one was the Court said that Rocky Mountain Helium defaulted on the contract. Flavor number two is it said that Rocky Mountain Helium failed to pay the rents without excuse.
Well, let me ask you about the point that you're just making about whether there were disputed facts. Put aside for a minute the two statements or footnotes that you mentioned. If I remember right, and tell me if I'm wrong, the government in its motion to dismiss said the Helium contract, the 1994 Helium contract, was terminated in 2004. Now, call it what you will, that is a dispute of your assertion in your complaint, if the assertion is read this way, that no, the Helium contract wasn't actually terminated till 2009. And that's why I asked you about whether you had made a challenge to the consideration by the Court of the Helium contract, and I guess the letter in 2004 that the government sent saying, we hereby cancel the thing, which prompted you to go to the CBCA, right? So it seemed to me they put that squarely in play in the Court of Federal Claims. When did the Helium contract get terminated?
The termination of the Helium contract was squarely in play. I totally agree with you. those aren't the facts that the Court of Claims decided that causes all the problems we're having now.
Well, why don't you tell us what those are?
And furthermore, I'm sorry.
Can you tell us what those facts are that you say?
Yeah, well, the facts are, and this is on the, I'll give you the reference here. It was in the appendix, page 9 and 10. Those are really the critical pages of the court's order. At the bottom of page 9, APPX 9 in our brief.
Right.
The court there said that the Helium contract was in default by the actions of Rocky Mountain Helium. That word default, every word counts. That word is nowhere in the pleadings. I have looked and looked.
But why is that a material element of the Court of Federal Claims? I took it that as to the Helium contract, put aside the settlement agreement, we can get to that later, but as to the Helium contract, the Court of Federal Claims, again, on the dismissal on the merits, the 12B6, said, I look at this contract. It was terminated in 2004. It was never reinstated. You don't have a breach claim for that. And then, you know, and then the court said something else about the settlement agreement, quite different from that. But just as to the Helium contract, which I guess is your count number one in your complaint, or count one of the
claim
two,
early, yes.
Claim number one.
Well, let me answer that directly. If one looks at the settlement agreement clearly talks about preferential rights. Where do those preferential rights come from was the Helium contract. And the settlement agreement talked about release of claims of preferential rights. That certainly suggests that there were rights out there. They hadn't disappeared. They might have been in abeyance for some years as this dispute was going forward. The government, yes, had advised it wanted to terminate the Helium contract. That led to all kinds of litigation before the Civilian Board of Contract Appeals. But it was still recognized that there were rights out there because it was in the settlement agreement. And then furthermore, if you look at the April 21st letter of I'm not sure what you want to call it, the drop-dead letter, okay, of April 21st, 2009, written by Leslie Thies of the Bureau of Reclamation. She said in there, the Helium contract now is fully, finally, and permanently terminated. Now, why did the BLM put that in writing April 21st, 2009, if it was really a done deal that that agreement had been terminated back in 1996.
Right, but it seemed to me, that language was kind of, Wizard of Oz type language, not saying, well, this is for the first time it's terminated, but really, enough is enough. Can we get to the settlement agreement claim? I take it your claim, and that was dismissed by the Court of Federal Claims, as I read the opinion, on the simple ground that there was a disputes clause in the settlement agreement that said you had to go, in certain circumstances, you had to go see the CBCA judge under ADR provisions that, unless you further agree, are simply not binding. So you got to go talk with him about mediation.
I want to, and I will. That's the second major error that the Court of Claims made. I started off by saying there were two big errors. One was the finding of fact. The other was the misreading of the dispute resolution clause. I have to emphasize, I can't do this enough, every word counts. When one is construing a contract and a settlement agreement is a contract, every word counts. You got to undertake a plain reading. There's lots of case law out there which I can cite that talks about that. It starts off by saying, except in the event of a triggering of the sunset provision.
And give us the page site and the paragraph you're referring to in the settlement agreement.
It's in the settlement agreement, paragraph 3, subparagraph 1. Just a minute, I can give you the
appendix 72.
The appendix number for that.
Right, 72.
72 and we've 73 got it. Are the two key pages.
It's appendix 73,
okay,
if you're there. But it starts off by saying, accepting the event of triggering of the sunset provision. Clearly, that paragraph was accepting from any dispute resolution requirement triggering the sunset provision, which is exactly what happened here, which is exactly why we filed this lawsuit.
I don't understand your argument on this point at all, because it seems to me that let me make sure that I understand what dispute you're talking about. It seems to me that the dispute you think the provision the government breached is they didn't provide you sufficient information, right?
Correct.
And so under the dispute resolution clause, you were required to submit that to the CBCA, right?
That's correct.
And now you're saying we didn't do it, and since we didn't submit that to the CBCA, and the government had no reason to expect that the information it provided was deficient, and then actually did sunset this because you didn't proclaim the things, you now can still go back to court and raise an argument that previously you would have had to go to the CBCA. How is that a reasonable construction of the settlement agreement at all? That it's you can sleep on your rights to submit this to dispute resolution,
sure,
which you agree it would have been required to, and wait until the government terminates the settlement agreement because you didn't pay the money, and then go into court sometime later to make a challenge that you, in the first instance, should have gone to ADR on.
How do we know? How do we know that Rocky Mountain Helium wasn't going to do that? Rocky Mountain Helium never had a chance, Your Honor.
How do you know that Rocky Mountain Helium wasn't going to seek to arbitrate it? Because you didn't.
Excuse me, let's separate apples from oranges here, Your Honor. You're talking about the issue with providing information, which was the pretext that the government had for terminating the settlement agreement. Let's talk about the first.
You're not disputing that the government provided information here, right? You're just arguing that it was deficient.
Right, which the settlement agreement in it said once that information, and that has to be complete information, is provided, at that point there is an obligation then for Rocky Mountain Helium to make its agreed payment. It never got the information that it requested. It got some, but it was insufficient.
Record did you ever raise a challenge to the sufficiency of this evidence until you filed the case in court? Did you raise it with the ADR judge?
It could have been, but Rocky Mountain Helium never had a chance to raise that and try to resolve that because the government terminated the contract before Rocky Mountain Helium had a chance to.
Are you saying the government violated some time deadlines or the like in this contract? Or that, because it seems to me that reading the allegations here and the factual allegations and the like is the government turned over data. And then it followed the timelines in this case. You didn't pay and it thereby terminated. Are you saying that there was insufficient time for you to review this data, or otherwise the government didn't follow the timeline?
Yes, that is what I'm saying, is that the government never gave Rocky Mountain Helium a chance.
What do you mean? You're being very vague and nonspecific. What do you mean you weren't given a chance? You agree you were given data, right? How long after you got that data did the government sunset the agreement? Did they do it on the timeline specified in the agreement?
It was... All right, I'm going off of memory here, Your Honor, because this was not something that was specifically addressed in the pleadings. I believe that the insufficient data that the government provided was sometime early in 2009. It was in the first quarter of that year. Rocky Mountain Helium said this isn't sufficient. They went back and forth some. And then before they ever got to take that to Judge Goodman for further mediation, the government said, we're just going to terminate the agreement.
Can you give me some dates here? I mean, where is this in the record? I mean, I'm confused now in terms of what the time frame was from the time the government provided the data, which you argue now is insufficient, and the time that they terminated.
Yeah, and this is where I'm just grasping my memory a bit, Your Honor, because this was not in the pleadings, it was not addressed by either party, but I believe it was in the first quarter. Let me back up. The settlement agreement was signed in September 2008. There was a period of time when nothing happened, and then finally the government provided some data, but not enough, and there was an extended period of going back and forth between the government and Rocky Mountain Helium over the sufficiency of the data. That was in early 2009. And then the government threw up its hands and said, I'm not going to do anymore. I'm sending you this drop-dead letter, which it did in April 2009. There was never any time when the government said, let's take this to Judge Goodman and mediate this information issue.
But it wasn't incumbent upon the government to do it. They provided data they thought was sufficient. It was incumbent upon you to raise that through these ADR procedures to the judge. Are you saying that the government violated a specific time deadline that gave you X number of days to consider this data and issued the cancellation before they were permitted to under the contract?
I can't say that. I can't say there's any specific timeline because none was provided the settlement agreement. They just said the Rocky Mountain Helium would accept the data. Well, you know, once it received the data, then it had 90 days to make payment. But there was no time frame for determining the sufficiency.
Wait. So we do have some time now, right? So the contract says once you receive the data, you have 90 days to make payment.
So, well, but the data had to be sufficient. I mean, that is just a good faith reading of the contract.
But if you're on your side and you think the data is insufficient and you know under the contract you've got 90 days until, under at least the government's view of the data, your payments are going to become due. That's clear from the settlement agreement, right?
Not quite, Your Honor. It's 90 days from when the data is accepted by Rocky Mountain Helium that the obligation to make the payment is due. But the parties never resolved the sufficiency of the data.
I know, but isn't it a fair reading that if you're Rocky Mountain, you're saying, well, I better get to this mediator before the 90-day clock runs out, because the 90-day clock is what triggers, in the government's view. So I got to resolve this data issue before my payment becomes due in the government's view, right?
No, I disagree with that. It wasn't 90 days from the time the government sent data. It was 90 days from the time the data transfer was complete, and it was never completed. So the clock never started running.
Well, but there's an issue in dispute by definition. When is the ADR provision ever triggered, then, under your view of the settlement agreement?
And what's the Court of Claims doing making a decision on those disputed facts? This is a Rule 12 motion.
Well, I'm here to ask the questions, not to answer
them.
So let me ask you again. As you read the ADR provision, if you disputed whether the data was sufficient under the settlement agreement, wasn't it incumbent upon you to say, I'm invoking this mediation provision or this ADR provision to the government?
It was incumbent upon both parties, if there was any dispute and they couldn't resolve it between themselves, to at least try mediation. And that's all that dispute resolution paragraph provided, was submitting it for mediation to the mediator in the case. And neither side had done that yet.
If you're the party that finds it deficient, it's your obligation to raise the dispute. If the government thinks it's given you sufficient data, why would it ever go to the mediator? You're the one that has the dispute. You're the one under the dispute clause that has to raise it to the mediator.
Both sides had a stake in making sure the settlement agreement was actually effectuated.
I don't understand at all why you're thinking the government would have had to take this to the mediator when they thought they had fully complied with all of their obligations. If you think they haven't complied, it was incumbent upon you, and you didn't do it.
In any event, the government refused to mediate.
Where is that in the record?
And that is evident in that April 21st letter. And it's
isn't
also
that after the cancellation of the settlement agreement?
That was the cancellation of the settlement agreement, and the final termination of the Helium contract was in the letter of April 21st, 2009. And after that, Rocky Mountain Helium continued to try to get this matter resolved through mediation with Judge Goodman.
But you'd already, that's all beside the point. I mean, the government, under the settlement agreement, they were entitled to terminate if you didn't make the payments. And the fact that you didn't raise the dispute prior to that mediation means that they don't have any obligation going forward to mediate. Maybe they could have nicely offered to mediate, but the settlement agreement doesn't give you any right to mediation beyond the cancellation. It specifically allowed you to mediate over the terms of the settlement agreement. And you didn't follow those.
Well, I would go back to every word counts in that contract, including the dispute resolution provision.
Well, I would too. I don't understand how we can grant you any relief when you specifically fail to follow the required settlement provisions here, the mediation provisions that you agreed to. And you're now saying, well, we're excused because this only applied until it was sunsetted. But under that argument, if you just refuse to follow anything and the government, you know, terminated under the sunset provision, then there was no mediation at all required. And that seems to read the mediation clause out entirely.
It takes two to tango to have a mediation. We cited the Stockton case for that in our briefs. And if one side doesn't want to mediate...
Just let me make this clear. I want to make sure I understand you. You're not arguing that at any time prior to the cancellation, you filed a request for mediation and the government refused to mediate, are you?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm not. The Court of Claims said that this matter had to be adjudicated before the Civilian Board of Contract Appeals. That word does not appear in the dispute resolution clause. It got that word from nowhere. All the dispute resolution clause said is if there is a difference of opinion, obviously the parties can't resolve themselves, they submitted to Judge Goodman. Judge Goodman was the mediator. He wasn't the board judge. As a matter of fact, the board judge had dismissed with prejudice this proceeding.
But also included specifically in his order a sentence that said disputes about this agreement shall be submitted to Judge Goodman for mediation. Right? You agree that's in the order?
Yes, I do. And that goes back to my point that Rocky Mountain Helium never had the opportunity to finally get this to mediation, the dispute over information, because the government terminated the settlement agreement before that happened. They went back and forth. They were trying to resolve it between themselves. And then the next thing that happened was the government terminated.
Okay. Thank you. We've exceeded your time. We'll restore 2 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Rocky Mountain does not have a valid claim in the Court of Federal Claims against BLM, and the Court properly dismissed the complaint.
Can we get right to the settlement agreement? I am,
of course, Your Honor,
confused by the trial court's opinion and particularly the ground upon which she dismissed the breach of settlement agreement claim. It seems to me that it could be read as a jurisdictional dismissal because the parties had agreed to these exclusive procedures, or that it could be read as a failure to state a claim because the breach, because the intended consequence of these things was the not money damages, but this exclusive bargaining procedure. And in the end, it may not matter that much, but I think we need to get the grounds for our dismissal or the dismissal correctly. Do you think it's a failure to state a claim or is it a jurisdictional holding?
I think the court focused primarily on subject matter jurisdiction, at least in that paragraph on page 10 of the appendix.
Primarily? Exclusively?
I think the court says it does not have subject matter jurisdiction. The court's conclusion is a little more broad in that it says both 12b1 and 12b6, but obviously that also applies to the lease claims. So I think the court's stated analysis is certainly about the subject matter jurisdiction based on these exclusive the exclusive remedies for disputes.
Are you aware of any precedent for the proposition that an agreement to submit something to voluntary mediation which may fail overrides a statutory grant of subject matter jurisdiction to a court to assert a claim? I couldn't find one, even frankly, if I thought of that this were analogous to exhaustion, which in the absence of a clear statutory override is not jurisdictional.
I am not aware of any case precisely stating what Your Honor just set forth. No. The court has seen that in certain...
And isn't it actually true that typically these breach of settlement agreement cases, even if they're in other contexts, in administrative contexts and the like, we presume that a breach of a settlement agreement can provide money damages, which would normally provide Tucker Act jurisdiction in the Court of Federal Claims?
That is certainly the for most settlement agreements with the government, I think that's probably true. I don't have, you know, facts in terms of numbers and percentages, but there are certain instances in which this court has said you have to look a little bit further. Although money damages is presumed for most agreements, that's not going to be the case in all agreements with
this is a commercial contract. Two or three kind of exceptions to the very strong default rule that monetary relief is available without having to be specified in a contract. I'm not sure what that default rule would cover if it didn't cover this.
The default rule certainly would cover any circumstance in which the government has monetary obligations as part of that settlement agreement.
Hypothetically, if the dispute weren't about the information, were the information was provided, they made the required payment under the contract, and then for some reason you refused to reinstate leases, could they claim a breach of that provision and state money damages? Because certainly breach of the obligation to reinstate, I think you'd have to concede
that has
to be read
monetary
as contemplar
implications.
And even if that dispute clause may have required them to go first to the arbitrator, it still would contemplate money damages. So at least portions of this settlement agreement seem to contemplate money damages and would be within the court's subject matter jurisdiction.
In the hypothetical that Your Honor has presented, in which there was a payment and then it's just a question of whether this was not the helium lease was not reinstated, I think that would be typically within the Court of Federal Claims
jurisdiction. So to the extent the Court of Federal Claims said this type of settlement agreement with a mandatory mediation clause removes it from subject matter jurisdiction altogether, it's probably not accurate.
I think it is perhaps too broad a statement, Your Honor. However, the dispute at issue here is about this information being given, and that clause does not have any sort of money damages for its breach. And there are cases
It seems to me that's just inseparable. The point of this contract is you, Rocky Mountain, may get an opportunity to rent our land in order to make some money off helium, which we want to do if it's possible. But, of course, we understand, we the government understand, you're not going to do that until you get some information about whether it's worthwhile. The information is going to tell you whether it's worthwhile to build a plant to extract the helium. And until you get that, we're not obliging you to pay back rent or to do anything else. I don't understand how that's not just an integral part of a commercial arrangement.
The helium lease was certainly a commercial arrangement. The settlement agreement, however, was more of a procedural agreement for how to resolve this CBCA appeal and how to going forward.
Right, and possibly put them in a position where, on a going forward basis, they have a commercial deal with the government. Can I ask you something specifically about the disputes clause? And what is it in the disputes clause, and I'm not sure I see anything, that says anything about the timing for the offering of a mediation opportunity to Judge Goodman? I'm not sure why that is to be read as saying that has to occur before suit is filed. Why can't it occur now?
The dispute resolution paragraph on page 73 does not have any timing requirements. You're absolutely correct in that, Your Honor. However, the paragraph 1.1 talks about how, and that's on page 70, that within 90 days of delivering this information, then Rocky Mountain Helium will have to pay this $116,000. So that gives
frame. But it's a merits determination. how the two timing periods, you've got basically 90 days to provide them information, 30 to ask for it, 60 to give what you got, right? And then they've got 90 or 60 or something.
They have 90 days.
90 days after that to make a decision. We want to go forward. We don't want to go forward. And if we go forward, we're going to pay you the $111,000 in back rent, and we're going to, you know, move into a deal. But I don't understand why jurisdiction over the claim is in any way precluded by a disputes clause that says, give Judge Goodman a chance to get you two guys to sit down and work something out. And they can do it now. You can do it now.
We have certainly not argued that mediation would be precluded at this point. I'm not sure.
Well,
exactly.
Except that the agreement has been expired, right? This is why I don't understand why you're arguing this is a jurisdictional case. Isn't this truly failure to state a claim? Because they can't make a claim that the government breached this data agreement because they were obligated to raise any disputes to Judge Goodman. They failed to do so, and therefore, because they didn't pay, this agreement was canceled. And therefore, there's no longer any claims about that specific dispute that should have gone to Judge Goodman. That doesn't seem to me to be a jurisdictional argument. It seems to me to be a failure to state a claim argument.
Right, and we posited both 12b1 and 12b6 rationales for our argument, and this court can make an alternative, can uphold on alternative grounds on a 12b motion.
Let me get back. I mean, this is what I guess I was asking about the timing question. I don't see anything in this agreement that says you have to give the dispute about stage one data before you know the time lapses, the later 90 days lapses, and you cancel the agreement.
Well, I think the key there is that the sunset.
At best, a question of interpreting the contract about the relationship between some implicit timing requirement, because I don't see any explicit one.
I think the key here is understanding what the sunset provision does and how it operates. It isn't read as something that the BLM must do, and then it sort of like terminating a lease. It is supposed to be a self-executing clause, right? The sunset provision is triggered by these events that occur, not by any notification by BLM.
Right, but their claim on the merits is it was not properly triggered because they did not owe you the money.
Right.
Because a precondition to that never occurred, namely adequate information. That's their claim.
And given that if their argument is that the sunset provision has not been triggered, then the dispute resolution does apply in that that the parties agree that disputes have to go to, and counsel agreed must go to mediation. It must go to mediation or some other form of ADR first.
So do no, first.
That
no,
this
no, first meaning, see, it's the first that it seems to me is the crux of this. If he just asked you, do you want to go to mediation? Is there any point to it? And you say, I don't know what you say. You say no, or you say yes. Either way, why doesn't the suit go forward? Either you say no, or say yes, and then the mediation doesn't succeed, and you're right back into litigating, which is what you said in your April 2009 letter, sue us.
So the question, Your Honor, is whether this is an exclusive remedy for Rocky Mountain Helium, and it's our position that it is. That this is.
It's not a remedy at all. It's go talk to the guy who might get you guys together.
That there had to be some sort of ADR, and that paragraph 2 states that once there is a good faith performance by BLM of its obligations, then the CBCA claims go away. That indicates that the parties agree that this would be a CBCA dispute and would be resolved within
no,
that.
No, they didn't. It absolutely does not, not in the sense that you're suggesting. To say they agreed it was a CBCA dispute sounds like you're saying they agreed that it would go to CBCA adjudication. This provision does not say that. It says go talk to a guy who might help you settle. That's all it says.
It specifically says ADR does not say
Rule 54, and Rule 54 says unless you agree otherwise, the two of you, it's non-binding.
That's correct, Your Honor, but it does not mean that the parties could not have agreed that whatever Judge Goodman decides is binding, that there's nothing in this agreement that precludes this from being ADR provision.
I mean, the rules have to be clearer than that. There's nothing in this settlement agreement that compels them to go to binding arbitration and get a result. I don't see where it's enough to say, well, that was something they might have done or they might have decided to do since it was an opportunity on the table. That seems to me fairly ridiculous. I mean, in any agreement, one could say the parties are always free to go out and hire an arbitrator and do it. I think it's entirely speculative.
I think the parties, by specifically agreeing that they would go to ADR, this has to mean something other than the background understanding that you can always go to ADR or mediation.
Well, no, ADR for mediation. You think necessarily that paragraph means ADR must mean something that's binding?
No, Your Honor, that's not our position.
Okay, so it's mediation.
Unless otherwise agreed to. That's correct.
Okay. So as Judge Taranto said, it's not going to bind the parties. It's not a binding alternative dispute resolution adjudication.
But it is a method that the parties are supposed to use first, and they have agreed to use as the way to resolve any disputes about the settlement agreement. And as Judge Hughes pointed out,
well, I'm sorry,
it's
in they can't the, be right. They did not agree that this is the way to resolve. Most mediation doesn't work. And it's completely within their control whether mediation ends in a resolution. They say, no, not enough. And I'm going to guess you're going to say, sorry, we're not paying you a penny. No contract, no money. Can I just ask, are you prepared to say that if they said, let's go talk to Judge Goodman now, that you would say, sure, there's a realistic chance that we could reach a deal?
I am not prepared. I don't have
I mean, after the April 2009 letter that said, sue us. We're not talking to you anymore.
It said that reinstatement of the lease, that having the lease going forward was not going to be an option, that anything would be about, yes, there could be a way to sue and get other information, but that
and
it was specifically taken off the table.
And monetary damages, right?
That's correct.
Whereas now you're arguing that under Tucker Act, there's no money mandating here.
Because the dispute as raised by Rocky Mountain Helium is about this information being given, not about whether the sunset, not specifically about the sunset provision or any other part that would mandate money mandating provision of the settlement agreement.
Can I ask you one date question which came up
earlier?
And the only thing that I'm seeing in the record is in your April 21st, 2009 letter, you start by saying something like, you had until April 16th to make the payment, and now it's 5 days later, so we're done with you. Was that April 16th kind of you start from the August settlement and add the 30 days to get the data, and then you get the data and the 60 days for you to give it to them, and then the 90 days? Is that how we got to that April 16th, or do you not know for sure? It's reasonably close.
I believe that it was after 90 days of the provision of the information. I don't have that specific date in front of me. I can certainly confirm it was not before the court below. It's not in the complaint or otherwise on the record.
Okay. I'm sorry. I do actually. We've almost not talked about the Helium contract.
Yes.
And
that's correct.
I mean, talk about perhaps it not mattering. But ordinarily we're obliged to decide jurisdictional questions first. Put aside standing for now.
Of course, Your Honor.
In this court, though not in the Court of Federal Claims, you raise a 2501 timeliness argument.
Yes, Your Honor. That's because we did not understand Rocky Mountain Helium to be making an argument that the termination of the lease was, in fact, its claim now before the Court of Federal Claims.
It doesn't matter that you didn't raise it before
the
Supreme Court said you don't have to. Are we obliged to decide that before we decide whether on the set of documents that everybody now agrees is properly considered in this motion, whether the contract was in fact, the Helium contract, the 1994 contract, was in fact terminated in 2004? Because it takes a little bit of reasoning, but not a lot, to say, well, the conclusion from that is the 2015 suit is out of time. Do we have to do that, or can we say, well, that's a 12b-6, there is no contract, you couldn't possibly have a breach claim because there is no contract to breach, or do we have to say, well, that's actually a timeliness problem because timeliness is jurisdictional and there is no contract, a breach is not.
So with respect to any claim on whether the termination in 2004 was appropriate, that would be a timeliness question and a jurisdictional, and this court should reach that first. To the extent Rocky Mountain Helium is claiming that the leasing, and this is what is in the complaint in count two, that leasing to another party in 2009
or 2010. That only lasted for a year. That's why 2015 is way more than 6 years after 2004 and 2005. Doesn't matter.
Right. And the 2009, that would be more of a failure to state a claim issue on whether a claim based on events that happened in 2009 or 2010 would have been timely as of when the complaint was filed, but the problem is the preferential rights had terminated well before 2009, 2010. That's a failure to state a claim rather than a lack of jurisdiction because the leasing to another party as an alleged breach of the preferential rights.
So if their argument is the 2004 cancellation was improper,
that's
they're
out of time.
On statute of limitations.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that's jurisdictional. We have to decide that. If their argument is that somehow the 2009 and 10 events with regard to preferential rights, they're not out on a time bar there, but your view is it's still properly dismissed for failure to state a claim.
That's correct, because those preferential rights, therefore, were exterminated or ran out in 2005, not 2009 or 2010. We therefore respectfully request that this court affirm the dismissal. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd just like to pick up with a question the Judge Hughes had for me, and I think we may have created a bit of a misimpression here. Judge Hughes, you had asked me if Rocky Mountain Helium had ever filed a request for mediation with Judge Goodman, and I said no, which was accurate. There was nothing to file because there was no proceeding in which to make a filing. But the parties had been talking for several weeks or months about that data issue and about the fact that Rocky Mountain Helium was withholding payment under the settlement agreement because it had not received sufficient data. So there were two things going on that the parties were talking about for weeks or months in the first part of 2009, and Judge Goodman was apprised of those discussions. He was copied on some of this.
But did you ever ask him to make a decision on the sufficiency of the data?
No, because he was the mediator. He would have not been authorized to make a decision. He was simply facilitating discussions of the parties.
I don't understand that at all. I mean, the order from the CBA dismissing this case said these types of disputes shall be submitted to Judge Goodman.
Well, I have to tell you that I have seen nothing in the record to indicate that either party ever had any interest in appointing Judge Goodman to make any decisions as an arbitrator or in any other capacity. He was only the mediator, only facilitating discussions, and the parties were in discussions for a long time before the government terminated the settlement agreement.
What is the point of suggesting him as a mediator if not to get his view on whether the data was sufficient or not?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
I don't understand your point. If Judge Goodman wasn't there to give his view on whether the one party or the other was complying with the agreement, then what's the point of the mediation clause at all?
All the settlement required was that a dispute be submitted to the mediator, to Judge Goodman, and he was certainly apprised of the discussions. Did they schedule a date to sit down and formally have a mediation? They hadn't gotten to that point. And there were two controversies going on at the same time. There was a sufficiency of the data. There was the nonpayment of the rent.
How did he ever know that he was being asked to opine on the government's compliance with its obligation if somebody didn't ask him to opine? CCing him on correspondence back and forth doesn't sound to me like submitting it to him for resolution.
And I would go to the question that Judge Toronto was asking about the fact that there is even a mediation. It's not mandatory. It's not binding. The parties can just say, no, I'm not going to mediate, or, yeah, I'll mediate, but we're not going to settle. There's no resolution necessarily. And what Judge Brayden did in her order, at bottom of page 10 of her order, or APPX 10, bottom order, she said, this has to be adjudicated before the CBCA. That was the basis of the court's decision.
Well, no, I mean, I get you. I think the way I look at this, her view that this was removed from the subject matter of the Court of Federal Claims because it was an exclusive alternative dispute resolution is incorrect. But that still doesn't answer the question of whether you state a claim for whether the government breached this agreement.
The government breached the agreement by not performing its part of the deal in the settlement agreement, and then it went and terminated wrongfully the settlement agreement by wrongfully invoking the sunset clause. That's all set forth in the complaint. You just talked about exclusive. I should point out the settlement agreement does not say anywhere in it for the dispute resolution. This is the only means the parties can have to resolve disputes. It simply says notify Judge Goodman. Submit this to Judge Goodman. Doesn't say this is exclusive means, the only means, or anything. And there's lots of case law out there. Johnson versus U.S. is one.
I got that. Can you just clarify for us on the helium lease issue? Because we have to write a decision, and I'm really confused what you're arguing. Is on the lease issue, are you arguing that the 2004 cancellation was a breach, or that the events in 2009 and 2010 were a breach? Or are you arguing both?
Well, I would say that ultimately the breach of the helium contract was when the preferential rights were violated, and that
so that's
was in
the
2009.
Okay.
That's what the second claim or first claim for relief talks about.
So you're not saying the cancellation in 2004 was improper?
It was improper, and that's why it was the subject of an appeal before the Civilian Board of Contract Appeals.
But are you arguing that claim before the Court of Federal Claims?
Yes, that's also alleged in the complaint.
And how could the Court of Federal Claims have jurisdiction over a 2004 event canceling the contract when you didn't file until 2015?
Because it was a 2009 event. It was April 21st, 2009.
You're answering in circles again. I see there's two different events. Let's assume there's jurisdiction over the 2009 event. There may be other reasons why she properly dismissed those claims. The 2004 event, if you're considering as a separate event, you blew the statute of limitations.
For 2004, that would be outside 6 years. I agree with that. But
okay.
2009 is when the operative events occurred that we're complaining about in the complaint.
Okay. Got it.
Thank you.
Your time has well expired. We thank both.